Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. It is full on winter up here in Portland, Oregon, and it's been pretty cold. And my pool is getting to the point where I'm excited to jump into it and start doing some ice training in the pool, Wim Hof style. Wim Hof is, of course, the guy that has the world record for time submerged in ice. I think it was like a big kind of like human bucket of ice. They put him in up to his neck. And he holds the record for standing in ice, surrounded by ice, without dying, which is, I guess it's something. It's pretty impressive, though. It really showed me when I first did it several years ago what the body is capable of. And I was doing his method, his protocol, which you can sign up for. He has a course. I think it's $100 or so. And he walks you through all the different breathing exercises. And for me, you just feel absolutely amazing. And so I'm going into week 5, which means that the first week was like a shower for 30 seconds, then hopping out, and just, you know, kind of just taking in that 30 seconds of cold. And then week 2 is like a minute of cold and then hot for as long as you want. And then a minute of cold again. And so it slowly ramps you up until the very end of the course where you're just also, sitting in a bathtub full of ice and not shivering. And I feel amazing. I would say that for me, at around this time, week 4, week 5, you start to get this just great boost in your mood and energy. And there's some science behind this. Actually, you can do a Google search for Rhonda Patrick PDF cold exposure. And she has a whole multi-page PDF talking about all the different studies that are done on the cold exposure and the benefits that it has for the body. So I would check that out. Anyway, I'm just telling you this because it's something fun to do during the winter. I feel like the winter is a good time to just kind of toughen up and really enjoy that cold weather rather than fear it, and this helps me do that. If you want to stay up to speed on all these adventures and watch me freeze my ass off, go to Instagram.com/KevinRose. Follow me up there, and I publish stories every week telling you about the protocol, what week I'm on, and what I'm doing. And eventually I'll be getting into some videos as well, so you can see me up to my neck in ice. And I have a few of my coworkers over at Oak Meditation doing it with me. So I think there's going to be a video coming up where we're all sitting in a hot tub, but the hot tub is not turned on, so it'll just be ice water. All right, so let's talk about today's show. Today I'm honored to have Tim Chang on the show. Now, professionally, Tim is a tech investor at Mayfield, which is a great Silicon Valley-based venture capital firm. I had known him and bumped into him a handful of times over the years, but he's a really phenomenal investor. He was named to Forbes Midas list for top tech investors, which is a big deal. I really didn't know Tim outside of just bumping into him a handful of times, so it was really just lucky that I was going to this conference called The Lobby, and I saw that Tim was leading up a discussion around consciousness hacking, and I'd always kind of been fascinated with this idea of what are some of the tools and things that we can apply to our brain to obtain and experience different levels of consciousness. And so, you know, at the extreme end, you have Elon Musk working on kind of like brain technology interfaces, but that's very many years out from now. Then you have some of the stuff that's going on today in the technology space, like TDCS, which is this transcranial direct current stimulation. You put these electrodes on your brain, and then you apply a little bit of current to them, and you can do things like memorize certain things faster. You can pick up new skills. They did this experiment where they had people play first-person shooters, and they actually got better while they were training with this piece of technology. It's extremely new tech. It is very scary in that we don't know what the long-term consequences are of this stuff. So I will say that talk to your doctor before trying anything that we talk about on today's show. That includes, we're also going to be talking about nootropics and certain compounds that you can take to obtain different levels of consciousness. This can be both legal substances and illegal substances, depending on where you live. So yes, talk to your doctor. I'm not telling you to do these things. I'm just reporting on what's going on out there. And Tim and I certainly both agree that any of these tools, they can be abused. And probably wondering, okay, so why are you doing this show? For me, it's just fascinating stuff. And anything that we can do to turbocharge our brain and to learn new skills or to potentially even glimpse what it's like to dissolve the ego, or what it's like on the other side, or a glimpse into this kind of like liberation that comes with this state of no mind that, you know, different Zen or different meditation practices speak of. That stuff is all fascinating to me. So I'm excited to dive into this. Tim is an extremely thoughtful person. He's one of the nicest people I've ever met. He's also really into this, and we also cover some of Tim's other passions, like his favorite books. We talk about his diet, because if you ever meet him, he is absolutely ripped and shredded. Like, he puts me and Tim Ferriss and all of our other friends to shame. The dude is absolutely ripped. So we get into some of his diet there, and a whole lot more. So I really enjoy this episode. I hope you enjoy it too. And I'm definitely going to have Tim back on the show, because we were actually traveling at the same time, and so we were able to record this on the go, but I would like to go in a lot deeper. So with that, here is Tim Chang. So I wanted to start at the very beginning for you.
Yep.
And just hear how you got into this kind of crazy world of all thing consciousness hacking. Like, how did you get started in that?
Like all things in life, it started from, I'm going to be completely honest here, advantage for sexual reproduction. It all starts from vanity. And what I mean by that is that's usually what many of us spend our 20s in pursuit of. Anything that gives us an advantage for that caveman brain wiring for a leg up on sexual reproduction.
You got to explain this a little bit more. I mean, so it was like for dating? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, in essence, I actually think our brains are wired, especially in the first half of our lives, anything to seek an edge for reproductive advantage, because that's our core wiring, is basically eat, don't get eaten, and spread your genes, right? I think that actually explains most of human behavior, especially in our teens, 20s, and 30s, right?
Yeah.
And so I actually have this little framework I call the five Fs, which is the routines running in your brain, which I think are the result of our survival programming to survive in scarce environments, which, you know, date back to when we were basically running the plains of Africa, right? And so those five Fs are basically when you encounter something new, your brain is instantly evaluating, should I fight it? Should I flee from it? Should I try to fuck it? Should I feed on it? Or should I friend or follow it? And I think, I feel like that explains 99% of most human behavior in any one moment, right?
Yeah.
And so the thing is, in general, almost everything we do is to gain some advantage to be more attractive so that we have a better chance at reproduction. That's the same thing for making money or getting buff or, you know, having a nicer car or you know, getting your LinkedIn profile more high level.
Sure.
All those things typically loops back to that one question, who gets the sex? Hmm. And I hate to be so reductive of these things, but that's often the core motivation of almost everything, especially in a young man's life like me.
Yeah.
So 20 years ago, picture this, you know, I'm a young product manager, hustling throughout Asia, working for Gateway Computer.
I loved Gateway.
Remember the cow spots?
Of course, cows, man. Those were the coolest computers. Yeah. You guys had the best computer cases out there.
Exactly. So I was totally into it because I used to make PCs for gaming and whatnot. And so as a product manager in Japan, where we had launched Gateway into the Japanese market, it was a whole new business model. I'm flying around. I'm on a layover in Hong Kong airport, and I'm looking at a lot of the magazines, the imported Men's Health and GQ. I pick up GQ magazine, I'm flipping through it, and I notice, wow, there's a lot of like ads for underwear here, but not a single one of these underwear models is Asian. And something in my brain just flipped and said, I wonder if I could get to that level. It can't be that hard. Never was interested in exercise or fitness my entire life. And from that moment, I just decided, I want to try this. So I picked up fitness, started learning about, you know, working out and strength training. And then interestingly, that pulled me down the rabbit hole of realizing, oh my gosh, 70% of this is actually nutrition.
Right.
So that was that quest of then nutrition hacking, food hacking, whitelist, blacklist of foods, balancing your macros, timing of all these things. And what's interesting, the original biohackers were bodybuilders. They're so good at this. They can time it down to the precise hour when they're on stage versus sort of body fat cut, all of these different things. And so that's where I started picking up some of that, which really tied in with quantified self well. It was the nutrition part of it.
What year was this?
This is 1998, 99.
Okay. So this was like Muscle Media 2000 was a big magazine, and Flex magazine.
All that
and like,
stuff.
So did you read all those?
I used to read those. And back then, well, they still have those ads for those now, like Nitro Burn and all these things, which are basically hopped up caffeine supplements, right?
Oh, yeah.
But there's so many of these that they've been playing with for decades. And so many other times they were state of the art on the original biohacking when it came to resistance training, as well as the foods and supplements you used, right? But then I met the engineering side of that later when I was at one of the first Summit Series events, and Tim Ferriss was there. Met him randomly. He had just put his first subdermal implant in to track his blood sugar and all those sort of things. Remember?
Yeah.
And so that was sort of the beginning of those quantified self days, those early QS meetups, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Kelly, Gary Wolf, all those guys. And I got pulled into it because I met a young entrepreneur named Nadim Kassam, 20-something hustler, totally off-Broadway background, didn't come from Silicon Valley, but he had a patent from DARPA. And this patent was to track biosignals of soldiers in the field. So it was very much the real-life analog of, if you remember the movie Aliens 2, right? Where the Space Marines have the colonel sitting in the remote mobile control unit, tracking the biosignals of the Space Marines mm-hmm. out there while they're fighting right. the aliens. It was pretty much that in real life. They never end up getting around to developing it, so they spun it off. Nadim somehow got the patent, and he pitched me on this, and I just fell in love with the notion, because I'd been into this sort of nutrition and biohacking. I was like, this makes total sense. If you could wear something on your wrist that you could see all your biosignals, heart rate, HRV, galvanic skin response, yeah. ambient temperature, etc.
So were you a VC at this point?
I was a VC. A young VC at this time, but this now is around, you know, 2009, 2010. Wearables wasn't really a term yet. Fitbit was so embryonic still. And I remember the main pushback was, who wants to wear something on your wrist to track your biosignals? Just people thought it was a crazy idea, but I was so in love with it.
Oh, I was too. I thought it was so cool.
It was such an interesting idea, right? Because I thought, wow, you can take charge of your own health. You can know what your biosignals are, what you're doing all the time. And this would be great for coaching. But back then, it was very early days, and trying to get something to market, it was so hard. We over-engineered the heck out of it. We were trying to do 5 sensors in one. We're trying to use pulse oximetry, you know, basically the green LED light on your skin to detect blood flow, all, and try to make it waterproof. And honestly, Fitbit beat us to the market because they just had a simpler application, just an accelerometer.
Yeah,
just steps. So that was an interesting lesson there, is when you're building out new markets, sometimes if you over-engineer it, you might be doing overkill, when just like a tip of the spear, simpler application can get to mass market faster.
Yeah, I mean, it's like that old Reid Hoffman saying where he says, if you don't launch something you're a little bit embarrassed by, you waited too long.
Totally.
It's like, get it out there, get a little traction, get a following, and add on.
Exactly. So we had a ton of interest, but it took us a year and a half to figure out how to make these things. But I will say the science, the data science, was so cutting edge, because instead of just trying to figure out data from one sensor, we are trying to cross-correlate from 4 or 5 signals. And that's the really interesting part of the data science, when you're correlating across things from heart rate variability, skin temperature, movement, movement type. That's when the data science gets exponentially hard. But I still think that's the promise of the future. Mm-hmm. It's interweaving sensor sets from multiple sensors and the data they kind of throw off together.
Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff. It's part of the reason why I'm really attracted to the Oura Ring.
Yeah.
It's just all the sensors that it has baked into it. And
yep.
they just need to hire a few more. I mean, they have some decent kind of charts and graphs, but there's not any... well, there's suggestions and it says, like, you know, take it easy today, yeah. things like that. But
that's
based mostly on, I would say, I think it's like the time when you have the lowest resting heart rate the night before, your heart rate variability as well. And I think a few other metrics.
That's right. And you know, what's cool is that's the stuff we were trying to get on the wrist. Now they've shrunk it down to the finger. And so you think, what's next? Would it be something on your ear, like an earring? Would it be something on your necklace, like a pendant? Would it be something you even ingest, like an ingestible?
Yeah, I have to imagine that we go into actually underneath the skin a little bit more, not in terms of like actually putting it like in the dermis or anything, but this idea of getting to your blood glucose levels, your ketone levels, all of that. I just don't know if that can be done with sensors. So many people have been trying.
We've seen a lot of those companies. I'm really encouraged by what you can do with the patch, you know, with the micro needles.
Yes.
The issue I've seen with that is sometimes your skin grows faster than the micro needle depth is right. able to penetrate. So you have to either keep replacing it
yes.
Or you have to figure out some other method to go deeper.
Yeah. We funded one of those at True, one of those companies that does micro needles and then was looking to do glucose, real-time glucose.
I think it was Sano or one of those types.
Yeah,
of
I think yeah. so.
So I'm really interested in that space. I agree with you. I think the implantable long-term subdermal wearable would be a really interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of keto hackers are wearing, you know, kind of like the Libra freestyles and whatnot, the ones that you wear that patch because they want to see their blood glucose response in real time.
I've heard the Libra's not that accurate.
Sometimes I think they have accuracy issues.
Yeah.
You know, not also
apparently
the real-time part.
The Dexcom G5 is supposed to be just a lot better. I've worn the G5 for
a few
months now since it came out, and it is certainly a lot easier to inject. Before, it was like you were pushing the plunger on your own
yes.
body, like injecting the syringe
yeah.
into your body.
Exactly.
And now it's just like a button, one hit, and it just does click, and it's like boom, and under your skin. So it's
that's
a lot
for the
easier.
Lancet the, when you're doing
that's
the,
right.
That's right. Or have you tried the one where you wear it continuously, basically like a patch with that needle that goes under? Those are some of the ones that people have been wearing.
No, this is continuously.
Oh, this is
yeah. The Dexcom G5 is like you wear it for 2 weeks.
Oh, right. The G5. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I think that's the next big breakthrough of awareness, is seeing exactly what food triggers exactly what kind of glucose insulin response for you, and getting that awareness, that's total nutrition hacking at that
yeah.
point. Because ultimately, everybody's mileage may vary. So whatever prescriptions you read from biohackers or food hackers, it's up to you to A/B test, because we're
right.
all different.
Yeah.
Some people, they'll go crazy on a Quest bar. Other people, they won't have that response to soluble corn fiber. You know?
Yeah. It's so true. Like, I've been able to identify certain foods where they say they're higher, like glycemic index, yep. but for me, it doesn't have the same impact. And then other foods I'll eat and just like spike through the roof.
Totally.
So it is very individual.
That's right. Now, back to your original topic, you know, that was on the biosignal side. But as I started thinking more, so back to what I was saying, this was all in a quest to just try to get fit. And, you know, again, speaking candidly, I think it's because I grew up as the wimpy kid with the sand kicked in my face sort of thing. And we're often passionate about that, which was denied to us for most traumatic growing up, right? So I think getting fit was a response to that. And I was trying to arm myself with knowledge because also I was kind of inherently lazy. I was trying to get maximum bang for the buck with minimal effort.
Yeah.
And that's where the nutrition part kicked in. Mm. But so I eventually did achieve what I wanted to, that, you know, sub 10% body fat, all that kind of thing. But then it made me think, can that process be used for other types of wellness? What does a six pack of emotion or mental state or memory or even your spirit like look like? And that's what kind of led me to sort of that consciousness hacking area. Could you take that same playbook even for your mental state, your memory, your emotions, all those sorts of things as
well? So what year was this?
That became probably, you know, coincidentally when I discovered things like Burning Man in like 2004, 2005, right? That's probably when a lot of a setting where a lot of people will have more perhaps of a quote unquote spiritual awakening, I guess, you know, you'll try things like meditation, yoga, you know, there are entheogens, all those things out there that kind of make you realize, whoa, there may be more dimensionality to our reality than we perceive with just our naked senses.
Yeah. So what was that first experience for you where you said, okay, this is something where I think I need to go deep here. I think I really need to try and figure out my own brain.
I think it was definitely a combination of early attempts at meditation. And to be candid, I fell asleep or my mind would just mumble. I just felt like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm wasting my time. Combined with, you know, the first times I ever encountered things like entheogens, like psilocybin and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And those, the analogy I like to give is it's almost like imagine you've been watching TV or movies in black and white, flat 2D, and suddenly you get a glimpse of an IMAX 3D trailer. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to unsee that. And so that opens up your curiosity, what other types of dimensionalities out there, and maybe the notion that perhaps the way we perceive reality is limited by our senses and that there's different ways to tune those filters, those antenna.
Yeah, that is really something I think about a lot in that, you know, the only things that we're actually perceiving right now is just what we have the toolkit, what we have the hardware to do so.
That's right.
And so, you know, behind me right now, there is, it's not color. It's mm-hmm. not anything else. Like it's something completely different.
That's right.
But for, I can only see, and unlock, and I wonder if there's more in my brain that I can tap into and unlock to get, like you said, a different signal, a different frequency. So you believe, what can people do? What can they find by doing this? I mean, I think that the problem that a lot of these compounds have is that they have both a recreational kind of usage and people will just have fun and there can be some damage done as well.
That's right.
And then also there's some people that are using it to get over fears, anxieties, or to explore their own brain. Like, how does one navigate this world?
It's always back to that old saying, set and setting, which is another way for saying, what is the intention that you're trying to bring to it? And for what purpose are you trying to use these technologies? Because again, these are just technologies. I have a whole technology stack of what I think of as like the consciousness hacking stack. You have, you know, the chemical ones, you're going to soon have neurofeedback and sensor-based ones, data AI ones. But even back to the old days, meditation is a technology. That's a sort of concentration technology. We even have social technologies like therapy, coaching, storytelling, shared groups, those sorts of things too. Those are all technologies as well. The thing is, they're not good or bad. It's what are they in service to? What are you trying to use them for? I mean, I know stories of people who try to use meditation to become, you know, better investors, or you could argue you could use meditation to become a better sociopath if you wanted to, right?
It's very focused and good at what you do.
Exactly. So to your question, I think what people could use are things that are sustainable habits every day, like yoga or meditation or some sort of mindfulness practice to kind of learn what it's like to go from narrow band antenna focus to more wide band. Mm-hmm. And I love this analogy. This is an engineering analogy, but imagine your sensor gear in your body is like an antenna system that's capable of measuring input from lots of different wavelengths. However, as we grow up, we tune them to very tight knit focused, you know, kind of apertures because it helps us survive. If we were trying to process all the information at once in wideband mode, we'd never get anything done. You'd be overwhelmed by the stimulus of the birds chirping and the clouds and everything else.
And this is the beauty of being a child, right?
Yes.
Like I'm watching my little girl and she can stare at a rock for 20 minutes and be just amazed by that rock.
That's
And you kind of remember that too.
That's right.
You're like, I remember being in that state.
Exactly.
Where Exactly. It was just like everything was so cool.
That's right.
And the ants and the dirt and just like it all, then everything would have its own little story to it too. Exactly. And I could imagine.
Exactly.
And yeah, you're right. So we pare that down. We tune it down.
For survival's sake.
Yes.
Also, our brains are narrative and causation creation engines. They look for heuristics and shortcuts to bucket things because, again, survival strategy when resources are scarce, right? You're trying to figure out, is that sound a lion that's going to eat me or whatever else?
Mm-hmm.
Or, hey, is that something I can make more money with? Again, so I have more attractiveness so I can have a leg up on reproduction,
right?
You know, that sort of thing.
So can we back out of that then? Can we say, okay, we've gone in and we were very focused at our careers and all these things that we've kind of like thrown away this idea of just listening to the birds and appreciating certain things.
Yes.
I'd imagine meditation, some of these other tools are ways to kind of re-remember and explore that, right?
Absolutely. I think that's why they are there as methods to kind of pare down the ego a bit, right? As well as shift our brainwave state away from the hyper-focus and maybe back towards away from, you know, from the prefrontal cortex to the anterior cortex where it's a little bit more wideband. It's less focused on yourself and maybe your own neurotic needs.
Mm-hmm.
And back to that mode where it's considering others or just being present and inhabiting the moment around you. Like that is the magic there.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's that you, you know, just stay in that mode. It's probably just balancing the two. Because that's the thing is we tend to get over-focused on, you know, sort of that neurotic, ego-driven state often.
Yeah. It's definitely a problem that I have. I get little glimpses of this just, for me, meditation is something that provides me just a way for my brain to finally be at ease and just kind of not be churning on stories.
Yes.
And so if every once in a while, I'll just find this beautiful little moment where, you know, most of my meditations are complete failures. But you keep at it.
That's right.
Going in, keep doing it. And then I'll have this little glimpse of like, oh my God, if I could just get more of that. But that's also the ego talking, wanting more of that.
That's right.
So, yeah.
What's crazy about meditation is it's this gentle practice because if you chase an outcome, it'll elude you. I think like everything in life, the more you chase something, it eludes you. But meditation, it's weird. It's like if you just sit, there's something magical about an hour threshold too, because I feel like the first 30, 40 minutes, you're literally just babbling to yourself.
Yeah.
And then when you finally surrender that, it creeps up on you. But the thing is, if you chase it, again, it'll elude you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the hardest thing, because I used to think meditation was something you have to work at, but it's actually this surrender practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of infinite how gentle you can just let go. So you can just keep letting go, keep letting go. And that's when like magic things arise.
Yeah, for me, that was my first experience with surrender was via psilocybin, doing a high dose experiment with a very guided kind of practitioner that walked me through some childhood trauma that I had with my father. And just this idea that you could just like release and surrender yourself. And that is so freeing, just to be able to like let it all go and not have to hang on to it. Like these little micro abrasions that you get that are constantly like, it could be a thousand little death by a thousand cuts that you get as a child or
in
your adolescence or whatever it may be.
I love that.
And you can release those.
That's right. The image, the metaphor I like to think of is, you know how pearls are made? An oyster has this sort of annoyance or disturbance and it creates sand and creates this beautiful coating of armor and polishes over time.
Mm-hmm.
Very much that's like us. We're born with epigenetic trauma and challenges we have and we form these survival strategies. And we take those wounds, we polish them into these well-armored survival strategies until they're perfectly impermeable.
Right.
And a lot of us get really far with that, but at some point you have to learn to just deconstruct it and let it go in order to get to the next level.
Can you talk about epigenetic? Explain that to people, because I think it's just fascinating research.
There is a phenomenon known as epigenetic memory, which is that trauma which occurs in a lifetime will actually get handed down in the form of mutation in genes to your offspring.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically your environment and the things that happen to you literally get passed down to the so-called baggage that you hand off to your offspring.
That
right?
just sounds wild.
Doesn't it?
Like the fact that it's actually going through your genes to your offspring.
Mm-hmm.
But they've proven this now. Like I heard about a study where they were, I think it was with monkeys or something, where they showed it. Monkey was not afraid of snakes. Had never met a snake before. They showed it a snake. It freaked out. You know, it did the whole fight or flight type thing. And then eventually had an offspring. And that offspring was then afraid of this type of snake or something that they showed at the same diagram or something.
Which kind of makes sense as an evolutionary playbook of learning. How do you pass learning down?
Right,
right.
Exactly.
But the problem is it literally is baggage you inherit from your parents.
Right.
And their parents, the unresolved issues. So in many ways, our homework in our lifetime is to heal and close that baggage, which is handed to us. And then we probably pick up our own baggage along the way
right.
and come to peace peace with that. And I think that's what this whole practice is about. It's not that you get rid of it or avoid it, because usually our survival mechanisms seek pleasure, avoid pain. And so we tend to avoid or deny or submerge these things until, you know, they keep biting us in the butt until you can't.
Yeah. Well, they get to a point where they bubble up or they compound, right?
They compound.
And then all of a sudden it's too much. And that's right. Where a lot of anxiety and depression, all these things, like they rear their ugly head, right?
That's right. That's right. So you eventually have to make peace with that.
Right.
And I feel like that's what the experiment of each of our lives is. Can you make peace with that and then kind of break through? And if you don't, you'll either pass it on to your kids or you'll succumb to it.
Right. Exactly, which you don't want to do either of those things.
Yep.
What is a toolkit for someone? I mean, we've got meditation. That's a pretty established practice. It's been around for a long time.
Yep.
And there's very clear paths to go and learn that practice. What are some of the other technologies and things and compounds that you've seen people deploy successfully to kind of like get into this realm?
Well, like I said, there's that stack that I've kind of thought of as the consciousness technology stack, right? We've got the behavioral ones we've known for a long time. These are usually mindfulness practices or ego death practices.
Yeah, let's talk about ego death for a second.
So that's an interesting one, because I've kind of studied this. When I got into this, I was looking at what have ancient cultures done. Ancient people, since time immemorial, have sought vehicles to break down that ego. And no surprise, there's often a great amount of discomfort or pain with it, because sometimes I think that's what it takes. The Lakota Indians, they used sun dancing or sweat lodges. Tribes like the Shipibo in the Peruvian rainforest, they would combine two vines and create ayahuasca, right? Mm-hmm. Many of these things often have a deep sense of discomfort, because sometimes it's what it takes to shock you out of your default mode, knock you out of your identity, and be able to then look outside in on yourself. And so basically, ancient man has always used what is ever in the environment as a form of technology to get to this.
Yeah. So what is, but let's go into what exactly is ego death.
Ego death, I think, is a phrase to describe what it's like when you start to realize that even your own identity, who you think of yourself is a construct. It's just a story. It's a narrative that's no more real than any other tale. And when you can step outside of that, then that's when you can kind of look at what has constructed that story and what the little loops, the, you know, epigenetic memory, the traumas that you have that form that are. Great metaphor I want to give you. Several years ago at Burning Man, there was a really simple little art project. It was basically a bunch of Christmas lights hanging up in a scaffold and a bucket of custom 3D little printed glasses, you know, the red and blue ones. Mm-hmm. You'd pick up one and it was imprinted so that you'd see all the lights as happy faces, and you'd pick it up and you couldn't help but smile. Another one had unhappy faces. You put it on, all the lights were unhappy, and you can actually feel a little shift there. Yet another one was dollar signs. Hmm. Another one was hearts. And the lesson of this to me was that the way you perceive the world shapes your reality, and all of us put on or have or are given different kind of glasses ever from the start that we see the world with. Mm-hmm. And that perception does shape your reality. Over time, you wear those glasses long enough, you believe that's what reality is. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with your even sense of ego and your identity. For me, I think the thing that's beautiful about ego death is when you actually don't have to wear the burden of being you, that's another form of incredible freeing sensation. Because I kind of thought about it. It's like, Tim Chang is not a real person. It's almost like a character in a play that I've been writing for years and that other people have helped me write. But being Tim Chang has a lot of load on it. Case in point, you know, I'm a VC, so there's expectations of what that is. You know, I'm kind of called a biohacker, so there's expectations of that. BuzzFeed once wrote this ridiculous article about, like, you know, my physique or whatever, and that created expectations.
I mean,
that,
you are ripped, so.
But even that's part of the identity trap.
Sure.
That I have to feel like I have to live up to every day.
Yeah.
Each of us, our story of who we are, comes with all of this obligation and these weights that to keep cognitive consistency, you'd spend so much effort on every day trying to uphold.
Oh, I mean, dude, you're preaching to the choir here. Like, I get it. Like, if I don't put out another podcast in a month, am I going to be less relevant? You know, it's like there's a thousand little things in your brain that are constantly talking to you and they're not all nice.
It's true. And what's ironic is, like, I have friends who are like social media stars and they crave so much attention on the way up, but now it's a prison.
Yes.
Now that they have it, they literally feel trapped by how much output they have to have and the consistency they have to keep have their early audience happy.
Oh, yeah. I think we know a lot of these same people.
That's right.
And I'm in that camp as well. It's like you have this success and then you have to, like, maintain it or, you know, surpass it in some way. And if don't, you feel less and you're like, oh gosh, those were the good years, you know, five, 6 years ago. And
will people still like
me? Yeah, exactly.
Am I still in the club?
Yeah. So that's all ego, right?
That's
there.
Right. And when you just take a break from that ego death feeling of like, I don't have to be that person.
Right.
It's that realization that like, wait a minute, actually I'm nobody. At the same time, I'm everybody, you know, I maybe contain everything. Maybe I am just like you, God, him or herself.
Right.
You know what I mean? That you are more and less than, you know, that story that you've been writing.
Yeah.
So I think that's what we're trying to get back to. And with that also comes a deep sense of connection with other beings and tremendous amount of compassion and empathy to realize, whoa, I'm just another instantiation of you, Kevin, or anybody else too.
Now, would you consider this enlightenment in a way?
I think it is a form of enlightenment. Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's two things I think any human is really just looking for, a sense of love and belonging, that's community, healthy relationships, and the other is sense of purpose and meaning. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that we get so trapped in what our egos dictate that we're looking for. It's always just out of reach or something in the future.
Oh,
or
yeah.
If I had this, it'd be better. If I achieved that, I'd be happy. But it's never really the case.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel like it's a subtractive process. The more you let go of, the closer to that happiness you are.
Yeah.
You know?
You gave a great talk, and the reason I wanted to do this podcast is we were together at the lobby conference in Hawaii, and you gave a great talk. And was it you that had mentioned this idea of slowing down time?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you talk about that? Because I thought that that's a great point, because if you're always living in that future state in that hunt for things are going to be better if I get this,
that's right,
then you're never here.
You're never here.
And then time goes really fast,
right? Goes really fast. The quickest way to kill your day and make it go by is filling it with all these tiny little to-dos and chores. You run around doing all this activity. Suddenly the time flies by, mm-hmm. days, months, years. And you say, where did the time go? But all of us biohackers, we keep trying to like look for longevity, maybe because we're scared of death and trying to stretch out time. But really, what's another way you could live forever? What if you made every moment feel like forever? I got to go to Sardinia earlier this year to speak at a conference called the A-Fest, and Adam Gazzaley and I were there. We went out for a drive in the countryside and had lunch in this little town in Sardinia. Their practices are usually to have 2-3 hour lunches right there in the seaside with family all around. And the pace of life is so slow. I swear to you, that 3 hour lunch felt like an entire week had gone by. And that to me painted a picture of no wonder they're a blue zone. They live in community, multi-generational. They don't work too hard. They eat a clean Mediterranean diet. They don't eat much dinner because they have a big 3 hour lunch. All these practices of healthy living, which drive longevity. But more than anything, time just has such a fullness that an afternoon feels like a week. So I imagine by the time you're 100 living there, you're probably like, I've lived forever. I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's another way to live forever, is just fully inhabit every moment and stretch it out as much as possible.
Yeah. But the problem though, is that we've been conditioned right now. Like if I were sitting at a 3 hour lunch, I'd be like, you know, after the half hour, I'm like, plowed through my food.
Right.
And I'm sitting there thinking like, okay, let's time to get back to email, time to get back to like, what do you do to address that? I mean, you must be being a VC in the technology space. I mean, you're addicted to tech or have been in the past. I've certainly am addicted to tech. Like, how do we get back to that state of being able to enjoy a 3 hour lunch?
Again, this is that subtractive process. There's a famous saying, which is all of mankind's problem stems from his inability to sit in a room quietly by himself.
Yeah.
That's how I often feel. I'm still a digital addict. I got rid of social media apps on the phone, then I deleted news apps, but my new addiction is e-commerce. Like, you know, when I need to do something like, oh, let's go shop for red shoes on Amazon or something like that, right? And that's the other form of addiction that's still there. And what I notice, I'm like you said, I'm never in the moment. I feel like there's something I should be doing. I'm planning ahead to my to-do list, mm-hmm. or what's on my calendar tomorrow. And what I realized is that the issue is that most of the time you're either rehashing something from the past or you're planning something in the future. You're never really in the current moment. Mm-hmm. And so it takes practice to do that. And even if it's not a meditation you're sitting in, you could treat each moment like a meditative opportunity just to be a bit more present. One of the quickest gateways there is just the way you breathe. You could just take in, you know, a box breath, that 4 count in, 4 count hold, 4 count exhale, 4 count rest before the next one. Even that'll slow things down a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Get into parasympathetic breathing, those sorts of things.
Absolutely.
I've been trying to do that. Even there's a wonderful thing I was once taught. I think it was the notion of savor the in-between moments. In-between moments are like when you're waiting in line or something, or you're walking towards your next meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Life happens a lot in those in-between moments. Normally, we think of that as dead time, but you can make it alive. You can fully inhabit each step. Just notice what's around you. You can kind of catch yourself saying, hey, mind, let's just look around and And notice, isn't that pretty over there, that tree?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like that notion of just being a little more aware. So you almost have to trick yourself into
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Thich Nhat Hanh once talked about washing the dishes. And he said you should be washing the dishes to wash the dishes. Like very intentional about what you're doing.
Yes.
So, like be all in
yes.
about that thing.
Yes.
And don't be somewhere else. Don't yes. be washing the dishes, pissed off that you're washing the dishes and thinking about your email.
Yes.
Like you should be really intentional about every stroke, every movement.
That's right.
I thought that was beautiful.
I'm trying it every day. And I think that is the practice of everyday life. You know, it's not in these peak experience medicine journeys or like 7-day Vipassana retreats. It's the integration of those lessons in the everyday mm-hmm. tedious moments of those in-between things, the doing the dishes.
Yeah.
It's that old saying, before enlightenment, you chop wood and carry water.
Yeah.
Afterwards, nothing's different. You chop wood and carry
water.
But you're just more present. You're more aware. You're more intentional about it.
Yeah.
Right. And I've tried to apply that even to work as well. I don't know if you ever had this, but you know, most of us VCs live in terror of losing money or not getting that big unicorn or being able to raise another fund. And it's very fear-based existence. And it's always tied to the outcome. I thought it was hilarious that all we ever talk about is what the exit's likely to be, you know, but you know, if you met a founder who said to you, I don't care what I build, I just want to be a unicorn. Like, would that sound sincere?
Right.
Like that's not like a novelist, just, I don't care what I write. I just need it to be a New York Times bestseller.
Right.
Right. So even that notion of, can you invest with more sort of joy in the process and the people and more on the everyday craft of what you're building and, you know, damn the outcome, you know, because right. statistically 75% of startups fail. Can we embrace that and still proceed and in some ways almost surrender from that attachment to outcome and valuation, which has become that disease that we're all, you know, suffering these days?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I want to touch on as well is just this idea of these other compounds that people are using. You know, Tim Ferriss has talked about this at length on his shows, like the idea of ayahuasca and DMT. And what are your thoughts on these? What advantage do these offer to the person that's getting into this space? What does it allow them to see?
I think it's an interesting experiential accelerant. What I mean by that is if you've been in default world and you're, you know, a rationalist or very stoic or doubtful about these things, and you've tried meditation like me and you've fallen asleep and it just doesn't work, it is a really quick wake-up call to kind of kick you into another state of consciousness. And what I like is that once you see it, you can't unsee it. But herein lies the homework and the trap is that instead of getting addicted or chasing that peak experience, instead of the vehicle, think about what the learning and the insight is and integrate that back in. Mm-hmm. To your point, what you're bringing up earlier, I'm really fearful that so many of us in the valley now are all like trying microdosing this, that, and the other and chasing more medicine circles because we're chasing the peak experience. Mm-hmm. We're chasing the outcome of it. And in many ways, that's procrastinating and not doing the work. Mm-hmm. The work is to integrate those downloads back into, again, the in-between moments, the tedious everyday.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I totally know what you mean. So basically what that's going to create is someone, let's just say I go do an ayahuasca and my mind is blown. I've seen new dimensions. My ego died 10 times over.
Yep.
I come out of that. And if I return back to everyday life and I don't integrate any of those learnings and I don't incorporate a practice that allows me to figure out daily ways to integrate this stuff, then the only time I'm going to experience that is if I'm back in that world.
Correct.
And so that means when 3 months are over or 1 month, next month, when there's another circle,
that's
I
right.
go right back in.
That's right.
And boom, I'm back in. I get that great experience again. And that is more, then it becomes a drug in my mind.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Like you're using a compound to chase an experience versus saying, I saw something, I want to get there. Now let me go do the hard work to get there.
That's right. That's right. Because, you've heard that saying, there's a framework where you wake up and then you grow up and then you clean up and then you show up. And those are those four distinct phases. The thing is, it's easy to get trapped in just the waking up part, but actually waking up's easy. It's the growing up and that showing up part. That's actually the harder part of it.
Yeah.
And that's where it takes the work. And this ties back to the whole, you know, kind of quantified self and the body hacking thing. Over time, I ended up renouncing all these hacks and lists I'd compiled over years because what I realized is that they all point back to the same 5 or 6 basic practices humans have known forever on healthy living, which is get proper sleep, eat clean, fast, move frequently, lift things, right? You know, meditate, manage your anxiety, and have healthy relationships. But the thing is, that's really boring to hear.
Right.
We like shortcuts. We love silver bullets. But the thing is, in many ways, those hacks, those prescriptions are avoidance of doing the work. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? The sustainable work.
Absolutely. I mean, having spent so many years watching the Dig front page, it was all about lists of 10 ways to do this or 8 ways to do that in 5 minutes.
That's
That is the content. That's the kind of snack culture that people like. They're like, oh, just give me a little of this and maybe I'll pick something up. But
give me the fix. Give me the recipe.
Yeah, it never sticks. I mean, it may work for like a day or two.
That's
and then all of a sudden, you get back to the old ways.
Even entrepreneurship, we seek like frameworks for give me the success, growth hack this, right?
Right.
But if you've seen before from startups, a lot of times it's wandering the woods, constant A/B testing. It's that discomfortable part that gets you to the golden land.
Yeah, that's so true. And I've changed my kind of like take on that over time, and that when I focus on a new product, I don't think of it as in I'm going to win.
Right.
I'm like, okay, I'm going to build something for the long term here.
Yep.
This may take me at a minimum 5 years and probably 10.
Yep.
And you know, if it's something that it feels like my life's work, like I really love the meditation project I'm working on now, that's something I could see myself sticking with for even a longer period of time, you know?
Yep. This is back to what you said of, can you do something for the sake of enjoying just doing it? Without the outcome, without a future expectation you're going to.
Right.
So that's what has shifted my meditation practice the biggest, was learning how to enjoy meditation just for the sake of meditating.
Right.
Not even to get to some, you know, like theta brainwave outcome or some, you know, kind of the equivalent of an ayahuasca peak experience, shifted consciousness. It's just, can I enjoy the every minute of meditation for its own sake?
Yeah.
You know?
Crazy. So, you know, obviously the internet in the tech world is all abuzz about ayahuasca, DMT, psilocybin, all these compounds. What's the bleeding edge stuff these days? What's the stuff where like 5 years from now, everyone's going to be talking about it, but they aren't yet? Are there certain kind of new technologies that you're tracking?
These are all the technologies at conferences like Conscious Hacking, Transformative Tech, those places.
Now, is that your conference, Conscious Hacking, or are you involved in that in some way?
I advise them. It's Mikey Siegel and his group, and then Nicole Bradford and Dr. Jeffrey Martin have Transformative Tech. And what I love about them is that they are trying to meld sort of science and ancient wisdom, ancient behavioral practice with cutting edge sensors, that like using the entire palette of tools and treating them all as vehicles for basically shifting into non-dual consciousness, one of the terms they've used. But I love that because it treats them all as different modalities to get there. And it's not, you know, kind of prioritizing one or the other or invalidating one. It's that there are a wide swath of techniques you can get there. And the hope is at least one will resonate with you.
Yeah.
Right. So Nicole Bradford has created this thing called the Finders Course, where she was trying to systematize a buffet of every known practice that have gotten people to experience this persistent non-duality state.
Yeah.
And it's like a 4 or 5 month program, but it's almost like a money back guarantee that one of these will resonate
with
you.
Now, is this a camp that you go to? What do you do?
She does it remotely, but it is a hardcore framework. It's almost like, you know, scientifically rigorous about the regimen that you do. It's a big time commitment. It's like 2 hours a day or something like that. Mm. But if you're really sincere about it, it's one of the closest and most rigorous, you know, scientifically, you know, kind of based things to tap into that experience.
So it's a massive buffet of things to try.
Yeah.
And then you try them over time.
Yes.
And then the hope is that you're able to perceive the world as a non-dual duality type place.
You're able to sort of step outside yourself, experience ego death, right?
Yeah.
Kind of sense that, oh, wow, it's not me or you. It's sort of like this we. Great analogy is, you know how in quantum physics, it's neither particle nor wave, but both.
Right.
It's sort of that sensation.
Right, right.
Right.
Have you experienced that personally?
Through many of these different vehicles we talked about, whether it was entheogens or lately more with meditation and other activities. And what I love is that it points to that there's one mountaintop, but infinite ways to get there. So instead of getting over fixated on which route you took, recognize that they are all possibly valid, that your journey is not necessarily right for anybody else, and that we all have to figure out our own path to mountain on our own.
Right.
And it may be a mix and match, choose your own adventure.
Right.
And so my goal is to help people with as many of these tools as possible. It might be through neurofeedback entrainment. It might be through binaural audio signals. It might be through entheogens. It might be just through good old-fashioned Buddhist meditation. But the point is that there are a wide swath of tools that will point towards that same outcome.
Yeah. So what are the ones that are kind of like bleeding edge right now that people really don't know? Is it the neurofeedback stuff?
Yeah. There's a lot of cool stuff in neurofeedback. We have transcranial magnetic stimulation. There's one I've tried before up in Mill Valley. Echo Rock practices one called LENS, low energy neurostimulation. This one was mind-blowing. It was almost like like an amplifier for meditation. What I mean by that, a couple small electrodes on your forehead connected to a small device, it would do a recording of your brainwave state for about 10, 15 seconds, and then it would transmit it back to your brain at ultra low energy for only about 15, 20 seconds. I did a meditation session with this, and I swear it felt like going into the kind of state it would take you a week of meditation retreat to get to. And we don't fully know the mechanism, but the working theory is that similar to, you know, active noise canceling headphones, if you show the brain an image of what it's doing, it's very sophisticated and can pick up on the subtle signals and tune itself or equalize itself to what it needs to.
So are you capturing 15 seconds of you meditating and then playing the meditation back to your brain?
Of just 15 seconds of your brainwave activity in that 15 seconds.
But as you're meditating, is it the brainwave activity that you're capturing? Is that what you're looking for?
It could be anything. Like for people who don't meditate, basically it's just come in and just sit. So quietly, and they're just measuring your state and showing it back to your brain.
Why does the brain freak out, though, and get you into that deep state? It seems to me like it would just say, okay, there's my brain. Hi, nice to see you. Like, why does it push me into a deep state?
I think the working theory is your brain, it's sort of seeing a reflection of itself and saying, huh, these kind of peaks are a little high and those are a little low. Maybe I should like balance myself out.
Interesting.
And so, again, we don't have the precise science for it.
Yeah.
And so, unfortunately, a lot of these areas still come off as pseudoscience until we have the reproducible data and the vocabulary to precisely describe the mechanics. But that's generally true of anything. Anything that's cutting edge is pseudoscience until we have, you know, the reproducible data and everything else.
Now, is this something where 9 out of 10 people that go and do it, they're going to feel something? Is it still kind of like, is there any placebo responders here? Like, how do we know this is actually working?
It could be because the thing is placebo response can be pretty strong too.
Yeah.
So we probably need to do, you know, double blind type of placebo type of controlled studies for this. From my own experience, it was pretty powerful. I've had several friends who turned me on to it as well, that this said similar things. It's helped with people with ADHD or maybe, you know, kind of depression, those sorts of things. Most of the stuff in the trans-tech and conscious hacking world is still on this frontier. We don't know the mechanisms or have the clinical data to prove it yet. As a result, it can come off pseudosciency, but it doesn't mean it's not worth exploring or pursuing.
Well, it sounds a lot like some of the stuff they're doing. Is it the TDCS or is it
transcranial direct? And we've got transcranial alternating current stimulation as well.
That stuff kind of freaks me out, and that people are literally, you know, in Reddit forums, like saying like, this is where you place the probe, like just go for it.
Right.
Like, what is this doing to my brain? What have you seen? Have you seen successful things there? Like, have you tried any of that stuff yourself?
I'm really scared of those things because, you know, you don't want to mess up your brain.
Right.
So the things I have tried, usually trying to make sure that there is a cap on the total, you know, milliamperes or the actual power output that it can put out.
Right.
You don't want anything in dangerous range. I actually had a really good friend who had almost like a cerebral hematoma because some brain hacker hooked him up to a machine to give him a demo, had the thing set way, way, way over,
then,
you know, kind of zapped his head and screwed him up for a few months.
That's a few months?
Yeah. And so that's an example of do not mess with this stuff. Be super careful and be really careful about sort of the energy levels that are being used with these sorts of things. That said, we have commercial devices out now like Halo. Low neuro,
right.
You know, all these sort of like cranial stim types of devices out there.
Yeah. I mean, that's better than the old, I mean, not old, but if a couple of years ago it was like build your own kit at home kind of thing.
That's right. That's right. So at least hopefully it's, you know, you've seen a company that's at least going for like, you know, FDA 510K or something that,
right.
You know, puts it in safe parameters for these things.
Are these things that you're funding personally?
It's an area I would look at. It's under sort of consumer health and wellness. Mm-hmm. I like to think of it as human augmentative or performance optimization technologies, but a lot of it is still very, very on the forefront. I tend to avoid things that require hardcore FDA approval. So like the threshold is probably the FDA 510K type of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I've been looking more as the passive sensing first. This is like the wearables that have sensors to read. And now we're crossing over into the write phase. And that's the stim and all those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Right. Crazy. What do you think about Elon's whole project to go into the brain?
That is the next frontier. We've got, you know, Brian Johnson at Kernel. We've got Mary Lou Jepsen with what she's working on as well. So it's that brain-computer interface. If we can really understand that, that's the true final frontier of understanding our consciousness.
Right? Is that in our lifetime?
Yeah, I think it could be, right? That's the ultimate thing to try to decode. I mean, our friend Adam Gazzaley, he works on these sorts of imaging aspects as well. Probably the key drivers for that are as we get fMRI, that gets cheaper and cheaper towards like commercial cost curves. Imagine you could wear an fMRI daily and then have it as a peripheral to your iPhone or something like that.
Yeah,
that'd be so cool, right? That'd
be really cool.
To understand those states.
How do you feel about death? Do you want to die? Are you one of these Silicon Valley, I want to live forever?
You know, honestly, I feared death for a long time, but I think through these practices, again, I hope this doesn't sound too out there, but I feel like I've tasted what is on the other side, or rather almost a remembrance of what it was like before we were human and what it'll be like afterwards. And it was very blissful and very beautiful. In fact, I'd argue the most deep inner peace I've ever felt, to the point where I remember weeping and just realizing, oh my gosh, the cosmic joke is that there was never anywhere to go, nothing you had to do.
Right? See, that's my concern with not dying, is you'll never get to experience and go through that transformation again. And it's like, I feel that might be the ultimate trap.
That's right.
Is like staying alive.
That's right. And wouldn't you get bored after a while?
Yeah,
too?
I think so.
Right.
And well, you get really fearful too, because I think if you lived forever, you'd be afraid of like going outside because a bus might hit you, and in which case you'd be dead. You know, you might have these really weird, odd fears that creep up.
That's right. And of losing what you've obtained or
right,
something.
Right, exactly.
But you know what I kind of wondered too is, I bet people, if you could live forever, you'd probably, as you picked up these mindfulness practices, you'd want to surrender more and more. This is something I think a lot about, because I'm actually less scared of dying. I'm actually worried about losing my cognitive functions, especially like memory or, you know, ability to think. And it's already happening as I turn 46. Do you get that moment of like, oh, that name was just on the tip of my tongue?
Or, oh, of course.
It's
I'm 41. So yeah. Are you ApoE 3-3, or do you know your gene status there?
Yes. Luckily, I think I am not 4. I think
so. You're 3-3. You're fine.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have an 8% chance of Alzheimer's then.
But it feels every day like my cognitive functions are declining. And it's really scary, because I used to be proud of having a memory like a steel trap, but I can't recall those words anymore and those terms. And sometimes I feel like I'm not talking as clearly or eloquently as I used to. And that's what I fear. And my biggest fear is, what if I forget my memories, that thing I did? But I even learned to let go of that, because I had someone put it to me this way. Even if you let go of your memories, what does that mean? You'll be fully present. Who has no memory or lives in memory? Young children. They're right. The most present and at play of all, right?
That's true. I mean, you'll be shitting yourself, but you'll be completely present.
You'll be totally present. But you know, that is again core to so much of what we do in the second half of our lives. The first half was just about getting laid and reproducing. The second half is like, I mattered. I was here. I left legacy. Mm-hmm. But even that is still ego speaking.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me having a second baby on the way. It's like, I want to be around for that.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That is a big driver for me.
That's right.
But do you do anything for brain health? In terms of compounds or...
Oh, yeah, man. I've tried most nootropic stacks out there.
Have you tried choline?
Yes.
Okay. Choline helped me a ton.
Did it really? Okay.
But I found out that I did the whole... I'm sure you've taken your genes outside of 23andMe and brought into Prometheus
Health
and all
nucleus.
That stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, so I found that I'm really bad at absorbing choline. So if I take supplemental choline, it helps me a ton with the cognitive stuff.
Oh, it does. Okay, good.
Lion's mane is huge.
Lion's mane, I've started Bacopa Monieri.
Yes.
The tree bark wine.
That's got a great anti-anxiety effect too. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Yes.
It's great before bed.
Exactly. That's a great one to take to bed. Glycine, a few other things I've heard.
Glycine.
Dan Party is one of my dear friends I look to on this. He does a lot of deep science research behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So his blog, Human OS, is a lot of good ones there. So we often geek out on this stuff along with Josh Felser and Dick Costello comparing notes. But
we should all get together sometime.
Let's do it.
Talk about this stuff.
Actually, it's kind of become a new form of like men's circle to talk about how do we preserve our wellness on all levels, including relationship and emotional wellness too. Mm-hmm. Back to healthy relationships.
Oh,
that's part of the stack as well.
Oh, I mean, I got to tell you, therapy is the best thing I've done with my wife. It is amazing.
My advice for everyone, do relationship coaching even way before there's a quote unquote problem.
Yeah.
You know, it's like going to the gym for your emotions.
Yeah. It's like they gave us the tools and like the toolkit that we have to address issues now and get to the bottom of it. And you realize when you're on the same team with someone,
that's right,
that you can get through anything.
That's right.
It's a beautiful thing.
That's right.
But it took a while to get there.
Oh,
we all
sure
come
does.
With baggage.
A lot of baggage. And you needed that neutral third party
right.
to be referee so that you're not like triggering each other.
That's right.
Right. That sort of
that
thing.
Back and forth trigger is not a good thing to do.
And the biggest realization for me is like, normally what you see in someone else is your own projection onto them. It's usually your own stuff that you're projecting onto
for
others,
sure.
right? So that's the other lesson of ego death is like, instead of like what I'm projecting, can I see someone for who they really are? And like, that's a really hard practice too.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other devices that people should check out there in terms of like things that you're doing or?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of the Aura and the Motive rings, mm-hmm. right? Those are state of the art of the wearables on the fingers. I think their software is only getting better. Aura to me right now is better at the sleep phase detection.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big one I'm hacking on sleep right now.
Yeah. Are you bad at deep or?
I want 7 to 8 hours, but what I notice, my sleep efficiency is not that great. And so I need more deep sleep, you know, mm-hmm. kind of creeping up on REM, but time in bed is not the same as actual amount of quality sleep.
Right.
So you need these tools to analyze. analyze what your sleep levels are. There's a new device coming out called the Sleep Score Max that uses, I think, infrared to analyze, you know, breathing. Hmm. So we're going to have a whole slew of sleep analyzers. I think that's the next big market is sleep coaching. Right. That includes not just supplements you take, but even sort of like practices like, do you sauna before you sleep?
Right.
Do you wear warm socks?
Yeah.
You know, all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Those are great kinds of devices. On the fitness side, I helped to fund a company called Tonal Fitness, which is kind of like Peloton strength training.
Tonal, yeah.
Right. And so just trying to, again, provide tech tools to help people understand and have better analytics of what they do, but then coach them in terms of what they, you know, can do better. I'm a big believer that until now, we've been trying to give people tools, recipes, info, but they still have to implement it themselves. And I've lost faith in behavior change by giving more info and dashboards and data. I think you have to almost automate, offload, or do things for people.
Yeah.
Because we have too much stuff overloading us these days.
Yeah. I mean, it works for the biohackers, right?
Yeah.
We geek out on that stuff. We love charts and graphs. And
that's right.
But you get to the average person and it's lost on them.
That's exactly right. Like, I'd love to see an evolution of like the Zero app that you have, right? Where it effectively just tells you, eat this right now. You know, don't ask questions. You told me your goal. I'm going to get you there. Money back guarantee. Just offload all your eating decisions to me. I gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's there's still too much cognitive load of implementing all these how-to practices.
Oh, for sure.
You know,
where does your diet land these days? I know you do intermittent fasting.
Yep.
What about in terms of the foods that you eat? I take you eat really clean.
Yeah. I got on this whole keto bandwagon for a while just to try it out. And, the thing is, again, you got to A/B test everything for yourself. Your mileage may vary. The thing is, keto is great for folks that are trying to get from, say, 20% body fat down. But if you're already sub 10, then, you know, where are you going with it? And we don't necessarily have a lot of data on sustained keto for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, at least for me, what I realized is that I was doing it. I was getting to ultra low body fat, but I was starting to have some weird, like, heart palpitations, all these sensations. Mm. And, you know, not to say that keto is bad or good. It's just that for me, I realized, I'm not asking to what end. What is my goal with this thing?
Right,
than just, you know, trying it out.
Yeah.
And what I realized too is because I do a lot of strength training, you know, actually carbs are good for me. So
yeah,
I ended up cycling off keto more towards low carb-ish. So paleo with pretty high protein on training days and then keto-ish on non-training days.
That do you worry about protein at all? Because there's some science that's starting to scare me that's coming out about protein. Have you seen Walter Longo's research? He's the fasting guy. He talks about protein in his new book and research there.
Yeah, I think, you know, unless you are hardcore strength training,
right,
there is way too much ability to eat too much protein.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah, because I guess when you're hardcore strength training, it's actually going to use.
It's going to use. If not, it's going to become extra, you know, glucose in your muscles and everything else. And so you don't need that much protein unless you are hardcore strength training.
I worry like 5 years from now, I think that people are going to start looking at protein as being like, oh, we didn't need that much.
We didn't need that much. And the type of protein.
Yeah.
A lot of proof that shows red meat is more and more inflammatory.
Yeah.
Add on top of that, you know, all of the antibiotics and growth hormones we put in a lot of the meat that's industrially farmed, those effects are still to be seen. Too,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That scares me too.
I got my blood levels back. My mercury is actually through the roof because I love eating fish. I was trying to eat clean protein and switch to fish. The cost of that was high mercury.
Yes.
Now I got to figure out how to get that on my system.
Oh, I've been there. Okay. Yeah. So I've had high mercury.
Oh, you have? Okay.
I got it out. I got it back to normal levels.
Did you chelate it out or?
No, I didn't. I basically what I did is I was doing a lot of cilantro almost every day.
And
then I was also doing the sauna a lot.
Oh yeah.
And it took me about 4 months or so. And then my levels are back to normal now.
So you know what this speaks to? I think something everyone in the audience should consider is that going forward, more data can be better. And these tests are not typically ever prescribed by your general practitioner
right.
doctor. And if they're getting to the price point of just like $100, $200,
right.
why not do all the, you know, a slew of tests for yourself every year? Otherwise, how would you know that you have mycotoxins or mold, which
yes.
I have, right? Heavy metals, leads, mercury, all these other things.
Who's your go-to for testing? I use Life Extension for some things.
That's
and
a good one.
I have a doctor that also does it, but Life Extension uses LabCorp, which I like.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. And they seem to put together these like longevity packages
that's
that
right.
test for all the heavy metals.
That's
and you
right.
can, you know, spend a few $100s and then
that's
you
right.
have the entire panel done.
I used to use Wellness FX.
Yeah.
And then I did a larger battery test with Health Nucleus. That's Human Longevity Institute, Craig Venter's company down in San Diego. That's if you want your full genome plus the big one, full body MRI. That was an interesting one as an early indicator. Plus you could do, you know, kind of like CAT scan, EKG in the heart, those sorts of things. The big one is your blood markers. If you can look at those, especially if you get get folks that do a full panel beyond just the basics. Sometimes they'll do mass spectroscopy to see some of those, and you can get some interesting reads on toxins. Mm. You know, a gut biome is worth doing, although yes. we still have to interpret a lot of that data. But I'm a fan of this sort of the more data, the better, right?
Yeah.
And as it's getting to affordable price points, why not do it? Arm yourself with the data.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. What do you do for probiotic?
I have been taking, you know, you get those general, like really good ones you'll get that are expensive at Whole Foods and whatnot, right. but I'm actually looking for a test to try to get a more personalized read on it, because the issue with a lot of probiotics is that they're not really that bioavailable. That's why the bottles always say this many millions of parts,
right.
because such a tiny portion make it through.
Right, like 10 make it through.
Exactly.
It's like 60 billion
exactly.
going in.
So please don't laugh, but I'm actually thinking about, should we go up the other end? And so
interesting.
There is, you know, a burgeoning field. It's really taboo, but it's sort of the notion of stool transplant.
Well, I've read and seen a bunch of people do this.
Yeah, apparently it's very promising for extreme cases of colitis,
that's
diverticulitis,
right.
et cetera, Crohn's disease.
But they say that you can, they have these pills now that are supposed to do it from the other end.
Right.
But I don't know, but you're swallowing shit at that point, literally, and
that's
it goes
right.
down.
And I still wonder what's the digestion, the bioavailability of
yeah.
that, right? Would it be a suppository maybe the other end or something like that?
Yeah.
The point is that the digestive tract doesn't usually let a whole lot of stuff get through. It's actually why most vitamins and supplements are worthless, because they don't make it through and get absorbed, right?
Yeah. Gosh, this stuff is so fascinating. Do you listen to any podcasts on this topic? Like, how do you keep
all the time?
Yeah, let's talk about. I want your resources for everybody, because I'm sure people listening to this are fascinated and want to go deeper. So,
Dan Pardee is one of my favorites. That's Human OS.
Okay, does he have a podcast or no?
Yes, he does.
Okay,
and what I like again, he's usually reading all the publications of PubMed, everything else. So he's looking at the real science. Big fan of Walter Lungo as well.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Attia.
Oh, the drive.
I used to read.
Yeah, he's my doctor. By
yes,
the way.
He's amazing. I used to read the Eating Academy ones, and like if you wanted like. Biomolecular understanding of like ATP
yes.
production and digestion. That was a really good one. I think he's got a really balanced view on things. I have to admit, I've steered a little bit away from a lot of the public media, you know, kind of quantified self biohacker types. And here's the reason why. If your business model is kind of just a podcaster, it's more like show and tell, and you're always on the hunt to surface something new.
Right.
But the problem is then some of these folks have these lists of hundreds of things which they themselves can't even implement.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been thinking more of what are the ones that are science-backed but also sustainable and implementable.
Yeah.
Because it's cool to have a, gee whiz, let's try this. Let's try nicotine toothpicks and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, just yet another show and tell kind of thing of the month is not necessarily right. a practical.
It's good for podcasts.
Good
listeners,
for podcasts,
yeah,
exactly.
But yeah, it doesn't really.
Yeah.
It's dangerous, actually. It's,
that's right.
If you're trying every single thing and a lot of it is like pseudoscience, like you never know.
That's right. That's right.
So how about Rhonda Patrick? Do you ever listen to her
yes,
stuff?
Yes, yes,
yeah,
like yes.
She's got a great podcast as well.
Absolutely.
How about books? Let's talk about both, well, on the spiritual side of things. Like I would love to know what books had a big impact on your life personally, and which ones do you most recommend to friends?
One I'd like to give to everybody is Michael Singer's The Untethered Soul.
Mm.
So clear. It's so just relatable, and the way he breaks it down is so nice. Naval Ravikant just gave me this one. I was going to show this one to you as well. It's a tiny little book called The Way to Love by Anthony DeMello. And get this, he's a Jesuit priest, Indian Jesuit priest, but the things he writes, you swear would be out of something out of like Buddhism or something.
Oh, wow.
Like
awesome.
This tiny little book.
It's a cute little book.
So clear, right? And so, again, one mountaintop, many ways to get there,
yeah.
regardless of where you come from.
So many great teachers out there.
Yeah.
You know?
The reason I like reading them is that you don't have to buy into the framework of any one of them, but there's at least a few nuggets that will resonate with you.
Yes.
And it's almost like you're describing the same mountaintop from like a million different angles.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Other big favorites, Osho, as crazy as his lifestyle was.
You know what? So we have a meditation instructor that has been practicing for several decades now that works with us over at Oak. And he said that he's like, you know what? Don't make fun of me. Osho's got great books. They're amazing. As crazy as that documentary was, like his books are phenomenal. So you're not
so
the first
clear.
Person to tell me that.
So simple.
Yeah.
You know, I had this mind-blowing one. I think it's on like YouTube or SoundCloud, which is there's no point to life. Life is the point. And when you really grasp that, they're like, oh my gosh, it's so true. There's nothing you have to do, nor you have to go. Just be present.
Yeah.
Inhabit each moment. Alan Watts.
Oh,
right?
Man. I have Alan Watts' entire library.
Yeah, I love it.
So I got his all. So I reached out to his son.
Yeah.
Talked to his son on the phone.
Yeah.
He sent me his entire MP3 catalog. So
yeah.
I have his entire
wow.
like, catalog of
oh,
work.
Oh, nice.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
And then I actually licensed a few Alan Watts clips for my meditation app, so people could go and listen to them there as well. So
nice.
I just was, man, his stuff is just brilliant.
Krishnamurthy is another classic. Yeah. And there's one Naval Ravikant turned me on to. He has a lot of YouTube videos. Rupert Spira, S-P-I-R-A. Really interesting talks there. Very mind-bending stuff. The notion that like matter arises from consciousness, not the other way around. Sort of like, you know, sort of we create the world around us because of our consciousness. It's not that the, you know, this tree or this house is inherently there. It's like some really interesting, it's almost like Matrix like kind of things. There is no spoon.
That's what I think about all the time. I'm like, the second I leave a room and shut the door, I'm like, what's going on in there? Because none of that is like there. That's just my perception of what's there.
Yep.
So what does it actually look like?
Exactly.
It's like your mind starts to melt.
Did you ever hear that saying? It's like, you know, you're not really human that's having conscious experience, your conscious is having a human experience.
Yeah.
It's that twist.
Yeah.
You're right.
It's so crazy. Awesome. So if people want to follow in, you know, you're doing so many crazy things that they, I'm sure, why don't you have your own podcast, first of all?
You know, I got to tell you something, Kevin. I used to love to prescribe things and give advice, but I realized I was just, again, talking to myself. So that's why I've gotten careful of trying to give advice, because I realize I'm just projecting my own BS onto others. And what I've tried to do instead, every great teacher I've ever had, they never prescribed, they never told me anything, they never held my hand or even gave me a formula. They actively refused to. They would only ask ever more annoying questions designed to get me to get to the answer myself.
Yeah.
So I've been thinking, like, how can I just ask people better questions? Maybe that's the way to be the best, you know, sort of like teacher. You know, I'm really terrified of those who call themselves gurus, you know?
Yeah.
Anyone ever call themselves a guru, just run away from.
Yeah, that's a good point. I tend to read a lot of the, you know, quote unquote guru type books. And there's always, like your point earlier about Osho, there's like, there's always something that you can point to and say, I'm going to take that with me.
Yes.
Like, that was an awesome point. I may not agree with everything that you say, but that was a great piece to just to carry along.
I like to think of it as like your road to enlightenment will be your own unique mixtape. So just like a good DJ, listen to all the things out there and pick the elements and make your own mixtape mashup that fits you. And that's your unique path to the mountaintop.
I love that. That's a great place to end.
You can't follow a prescription.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Tim, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
All right. That is it for this episode. If you enjoyed it, head on over to iTunes, search for The Kevin Rose Show. And if you would leave me a 5-star review, that would be awesome. That gets this content recommended to more people. And in turn, we get better guests on the show. Also, just a quick reminder, follow me up at Instagram.com/KevinRose. See you soon.